The afternoon argument for the southern panel is Tower Homes LLC versus William H. Heaton and its Walton and Heaton, case number 65755. Mr. Prince, you're ready to go.
I am.
Okay, please proceed.
Also with me is Mr. Ian Estrada, who is also a co-counsel for the plaintiff Tower Homes.
Hi. Glad to have you here. Okay.
Your Honor, respectfully, Justice Hartley, I'm going to reserve 5 minutes for the rebuttal today.
Okay.
If it pleases the court, the mere fact that proceeds of a lawsuit may go to others is not dispositive of the issue of an impermissible assignment. This court made clear in Akram that an assignment of proceeds from a tort action did not constitute an impermissible assignment of either a legal malpractice action, since it was directed towards a lawyer specifically, or a tort action generally. Also, in this court, in the Arguello versus Sunset Station case, the fact that the insured of the Farmers Insurance Company was bringing a subrogation action, even though the insurer had already paid a substantial portion of the claim, did not vitiate the standing of the insured's ability to pursue for the entire amount of the loss. And what we're talking about here is what happens when a entity files bankruptcy. Because when a corporation files bankruptcy, there's an automatic transfer of rights. There's an automatic legal assignment of rights to the bankruptcy estate. And the estate becomes the holder of all of the property rights of the debtor that existed on the date of the filing, including any choses of an action, any lawsuits, any potential claims against third parties, professionals, or otherwise. And that's a very valuable right to a bankruptcy estate in the sense that it enables the estate, assuming there's resources to pursue it, to obtain recovery from third parties, including professionals, to help administer the estate and pay the claims of creditors. Now here, there's no question that the entity suing Tower Homes LLC, that is not only the debtor but also the client of the law firm. The bankruptcy court specifically authorized in its April 2013 order the ability of Tower Homes LLC to pursue this specific action, and it was conferred that right by the trustee and ultimately approved by the bankruptcy court. Now, what we're talking about here is fundamentally, and at the heart of this appeal, is what is the scope of a bankruptcy court's authority to authorize an action to be pursued against a legal professional. There's no question that upon the filing of the bankruptcy, all of the rights that Tower Homes had against the law firm were transferred to the bankruptcy estate. And it, as part of the plan approval, the bankruptcy estate, and specifically the trustee, retained those rights to pursue all claims, including any claim against this particular law firm, in order to administer the estate. Now, under Section 1123B3B, that enables three people to enforce the rights: the trustee, the debtor, or a representative of the estate. While initially in the confirmation order of the plan, the authority was conferred upon the trustee, by operation of the April 2013 order, that authority then became the ability of the Tower Homes purchasers on behalf of the corporate debtor to pursue this claim in the name of the debtor. The mere fact that the proceeds are going to go to third parties, meaning these particular creditors, as opposed to the bankruptcy estate generally, does not in any way limit the standing of the debtor to pursue these claims. Now, every time a corporation files bankruptcy and there is an action pursued to recover monies, those monies are going to be allocated to creditors, whether secured creditors and unsecured creditors, depending upon the available assets of the bankruptcy estate. The argument that just because monies are going to be going to third parties, that does not limit the standing or the legal authority to sue. So what we're talking about is there the right to pursue this action? And the answer to that question is Controvertibly, yes. The April 2nd, 2013 order confers the authority to allow this action to pursue, and I believe that action is appropriate under 1123B3B, which gives the authority of the trustee as well as the debtor to pursue this action. Just because it was initially conferred upon the trustee doesn't mean the court can't enter an appropriate order to allow the action to pursue in the name of the debtor itself. Now, the practical reality of this case...
Just for clarification, Mr. Prince, was the right to pursue the malpractice claim and the right to retain the proceeds part of the debtor's plan, or was this simply a separate order distributing it to these creditors, which was consented to by the trustee and the rest of the estate? I wonder if you could comment on that, because one of the questions, as you know, in this case is whether the order or the plan operates as an assignment from a potentially impermissible assignment from the estate as an entity to the your clients who are creditors.
Right. At the beginning, at the filing of the petition, there's already a legal assignment of all rights. So any right that Tower Homes had that they existed as of the date of the filing, which we contend predated the filing or was pre-petition, that automatically transferred to the bankruptcy estate. And under the terms of
arguably the claim is an inchoate claim that would become part of the bankruptcy estate. I don't think there was any assignment when the LLC filed for bankruptcy. Its assets, including its intangible or inchoate claims, would be part of the estate, right?
It'd become part of the estate. Okay. That's right. I'm calling that a form of an assignment, because now the estate holds all of the rights. The debtor individually does not hold the rights any longer. But under the plan, the plan did confer upon the trustee the ability to pursue all retained causes of action or these types of choses in action. The state retained those and appointed the trustee as the person with the ability to pursue those claims and administer in accordance with the confirmed plan. It wasn't until the April 8, 2013 order was entered that the bankruptcy court, after a hearing on April 1st, 2013, approved the stipulation with the trustee to allow the Tower Homes purchasers to pursue in the name of the debtor this specific action. And then as a result of that, since they're the ones putting their asset at risk and paying for all of the costs associated with the action, they have the right to retain those proceeds. Now the question is, well, what interest does the debtor have in this case? The debtor has an interest in making sure that its creditors are paid. This particular debtor availed itself of the United States Bankruptcy Code and was seeking a fresh start. One of the benefits of that, and when they confirmed a Chapter 11 plan, was that there is going to be a plan of reorganization to enable it to have a fresh start and pay its creditors' claims, both secured and unsecured. So they do retain an interest in that.
Well, but that was at the heart of my question. In essence, the right to pursue this claim was assigned to your clients in exchange for the resolution of their claims against the estate.
My client was certainly given the ability and authority to pursue it on behalf of the debtor. The claim wasn't assigned. The claim always remained property of the estate and of the debtor.
But the consideration in return is that your clients no longer had a claim against the bankruptcy estate. Once they got
that, that would be true. That then they're going to be satisfied.
That was the consideration for allowing you to pursue the claim.
That they're going to be, they can retain any proceeds from the settlement. That's
so. The question, the legal question posed in this case, is whether that should be considered an assignment of a legal malpractice claim. Your position is it should not. Why not?
Because the only thing that was assigned was the right to retain proceeds. The right to pursue the action the actual holder of the action, that was never assigned. That was retained by Tower Homes LLC. For example, there's nothing in the order that says we're assigning to you Tower Homes purchasers, all the individual purchasers, the claims against the law firm, and you can pursue them in your own name. There is no such an assignment because that would enable them to proceed directly. The trustee, along with the bankruptcy court, we believe under Section 1123, had the authority and ability to give the debtor or a representative, meaning Tower Homes purchasers, the ability to pursue those claims in the name of the debtor directly. And that's what happened here.
Other than this being pursued in the name of the debtor, though, are there any indicia in this relationship that would suggest anyone other than the purchasers was the true driver of the claim and beneficiary of any proceeds? In other words, I get that this was nominally in Tower Homes' name, but other than that, is there anything that suggests the purchasers were not the true holders of that claim at that point?
The true holders of the legal malpractice claim you're talking about? I think they were empowered to pursue the claim on behalf of their and retain those proceeds.
Proceeds yielded more than the total amount of their claim, what then?
Well, I think their damage would have been capped at the proceeds because it was the claim was the loss of the deposit. So that would have been the scope of the recovery. Well, it is going to be the scope of the recovery.
And let's say that they wanted to dismiss the suit with prejudice because they felt it was couldn't be maintained economically, the litigation. Was that something they were entitled to decide on their own?
I believe so, yes. And the reason why and why this is such an important fundamental issue is the estate determined it didn't have the resources to pursue the claim.
Right.
And that's a critically important issue.
So it abandoned the claim and lent its name to the plaintiffs, but was there any other estate involvement after that point, any other bankruptcy estate involvement?
No, other than the money would have to go back into the estate and then have to be distributed accordingly, in my view of the order. I don't think you could just keep the proceeds without having them at least go through the estate and have the trustee administer the proceeds so the claims could be appropriately
satisfied.
Were
there other creditors than these purchasers to whom the proceeds would be distributed?
No, not based upon the order. These would be the only creditors of this estate since they're putting their assets at risk in pursuing it. Now, with regard to that, the practical reality is there may be many times where a bankruptcy estate or a debtor has valuable legal rights against a third party, but unfortunately don't have the resources to pursue it. And therefore, creditors are going to be left not being fully satisfied because of the estate's inability to pursue the claim, in which case you're going to have people who or entities who are legally accountable to the debtor for potentially substantial sums of money, which could go to the creditors to satisfy their otherwise legitimate claims, those rights are going to be lost. And the culpable party, the tortfeasor, if you will, is not going to be held accountable for their actions, even though they did cause harm and they did cause damage. And that is a significant policy consideration. I don't think, even though I'm a little past my time, I may reserve the last moment for my rebuttal. Unlike in the Godley case where they're worried about the commercialization and or marketization of legal malpractice claims, this is a very narrow circumstance. This isn't someone who went out on the street and through some sort of marketplace and bought a claim. This was through an administered plan of reorganization and in furtherance of the bankruptcy code with the approval of the bankruptcy court who specifically authorized this action in the name of the debtor.
Does the record show if this has been converted to a 7 or if it's still?
It remained an 11.
Okay.
It was never converted, to my knowledge, after the plan of reorganization was in fact approved. Normally the conversion would be prior to the adoption of the plan, but after the plan was adopted, I'm not sure that it was. I don't have any record of that.
Another one, no outside the record.
All right, so I don't have any record of that. And with that, I'll submit it and I'll reserve my remaining time for the rebuttal.
We had some questions for Mr. Prince, so Ms. Clerk, add a minute to his rebuttal time, and we'll give 16 minutes to counsel for Eaton et al. Mr. Ulster.
May it please the Court. My name is Jeff Ulster. I represent Mr. Heaton and Nitz Walton Heaton. I will keep with the briefs and refer to the respondents as NWH. You have a pretty lengthy record on this appeal. There's one thing you will not see in that entire record. You will not see a single case from any jurisdiction that authorizes this type of action. In other words, an action brought by strangers to an attorney-client relationship, bringing an action for their own benefit when a bankruptcy has been fully administered. Not one. Now, this notion that this is just about the assignment of proceeds and not the action itself has several flaws. First of all, that wasn't argued in the district court proceedings below, so it shouldn't be considered here. But even if you want to consider it, it doesn't make a difference. The Akron case, first of all, says that the proceeds of a tort claim, an injury claim, your run-of-the-mill tort claim, the proceeds can be assigned. It doesn't go that far with legal malpractice claims. Legal malpractice claims invoke different concerns. You've got a confidential relationship. You've got very different concerns. So it's an overreading of Akron to say that Akron would authorize an assignment of proceeds. But even more fundamentally, this case is not just about an assignment of proceeds. This is an actual assignment of the claim, and I think your questions hit on that. And really, the critical piece of paper in the case is the second Markey Orbach order. It's Appellate's Appendix 839, and it's at various other places. And what it does is it authorizes the trustee to permit the Tower Homes purchasers to pursue the claim. This is not a legal malpractice claim that was previously asserted by the client. That's critical. The client had every opportunity to assert these claims going back to even 2006, and it chose not to, probably because it had no basis to do so, probably because of the misappropriation of the funds by the client itself. So, The other touchstone about whether you've got an assignment of claims and assignment of proceeds is who's controlling the claim. Justice Pickering, as you questioned Mr. Prince, he conceded that the right to dismiss this action lies with the purchasers. The right to prosecute this action lies with the purchasers. They're only authorized to bring this action through their attorneys, and they are the sole beneficiaries of the proceeds. So there's lots of case law in our briefs, but these are all the critical factors in distinguishing between when you have an assignment of a claim and when you have an assignment of proceeds. There is no...
I get the distinction that you make about the fact that a legal malpractice claim shouldn't fall into this assignment of tort claim approach, but let me just share with you that... For a number of years, I represented several trustees in bankruptcy. Routinely, at least, my experience was that the trustee would retain counsel for a creditor, for example, to come in and represent the estate to prosecute these claims on behalf of the estate. But I do think that this raises an interesting question about when the state receives a financial benefit, they get rid of these creditors. So they basically pay off this group of creditors by assigning them an intangible claim. What's wrong with that? What about counsel's argument under the bankruptcy code that section subparagraph 3 permits a representative to prosecute the claim?
Representative actions are certainly permitted. This isn't that. A representative action requires a disinterested professional pursuing the claim, number one. It also requires a bankruptcy purpose. It requires that those funds from the proceedings inure to the bankruptcy estate. When you're singling out one...
Well, I guess that's the point, doesn't it, though? If in fact the plan said, okay, this group of creditors we're going to deal with in this fashion, we're going to assign them this intangible claim, so that any other assets that the Chapter 11 estate acquires is going to be used to pay other creditors, the estate has received a benefit, haven't they?
Well, but perhaps. I think we implicate again, though, the policy concerns about singling out a legal malpractice claim and the marketization of legal malpractice claims, the breach of the confidential relationship that you have, and...
So you're saying that a state law prohibition against the assignment of legal malpractice claims should be read into the representative capacity under the federal bankruptcy code?
And that's what every court that has addressed this issue has concluded. For example, the Baum case from California, the Curtis case from California. These are on all fours. These are cases where the California Court of Appeals has said, we know that this is what they tried to do, but the bankruptcy code doesn't allow this, and state law doesn't allow it. The state federal bankruptcy law or a negotiated deal between a bankruptcy trustee and some creditors doesn't override a state law prohibition against assignment of claims. This issue has been decided by the California Court of Appeals. And the other core part of the analysis is that the real party and interest analysis under NRCP 17. And what this means is that an action shall be brought by the party who possesses the right to enforce the claim and who has a significant interest in the claim. That means that what we have here is the Tower Homes purchasers as the real parties in interest. They're the only party with the right to bring this claim based on the second Marquis Arbeck order, and they're the only party who stands to benefit from the action. So they're the real party in interest. We have to look at the case from that perspective, this notion that a corporate shell can be used to bring a claim like this has been rejected, again, by every court that has been presented with this situation.
Well, is it a corporate shell? I mean, I understood this is a Chapter 11, so isn't the LLC operating as a Chapter 11 entity post-plan approval?
It's not. It's a defunct shell that effectively went out of business in 2006 when the development failed. And importantly, this bankruptcy estate has been administered. In every other case... Where
so is it closed?
Yes.
Is that part of the record?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yes. In our reply brief on the motion for summary judgment.
Okay.
And so that is a critical point of distinction between this case and every other type of representative action that you see. For example, the agribiotech cases, those were discussed in the briefs. Those are cases where you have an ongoing bankruptcy proceeding and you have a true representative action that's brought to benefit the estate as a whole. We don't have that here. No bankruptcy purpose is now served by this action. Whether it's pursued or not, it doesn't matter.
You don't dispute, though, that the trustee could have retained Mr. Prince on a contingency or some other arrangement that didn't require an outlay of funds, and he could have proceeded in the name of the debtor against your client.
If Mr. Prince was not representing the Tower Homes purchasers, if he was a disinterested professional, it could have been structured that way.
Well, whether or not that's a basis for his disqualification, that's a separate question. I mean... He could have been retained by the trustee to prosecute the claim on behalf of the estate, couldn't he?
I believe the bankruptcy code requires a disinterested representative.
Was there any objection to this arrangement in the bankruptcy litigation that resulted in the transfer of the claim?
Not that I'm aware of, no. But the additional concern we have here is that it's not just an assignment. It's not just a present transferring of a present right, but it's a transfer of a right to a litigation adversary. And a lot of the case law from other states goes into the policy reasons why we don't want that. By litigation adversary, I mean the Tower Homes purchasers had sued Tower Homes in underlying litigation. So when you have that type of situation, you have concerns about whether attorneys are going to represent judgment-proof parties because of the potential for collusion and the potential for the litigation adversaries to get together and say, hey, let's go after the bigger pot, and that's my attorneys. And in a sense, that's part of the dynamic that was going on here. So that's another aspect of this case that makes it even more compelling than even Baum and Curtis, which didn't really deal with that litigation adversary dynamic, and yet still the California Court of Appeals in those cases said, look, you cannot assign the right to one creditor to pursue a claim using a corporate shell. Now, I mean, the other issue here, which has been before this court, is the issue of the statute of limitations. And you have every right to rule on issues that were briefed in the court below. And, you know, again, as we've previously argued, and it was up on a writ before this court, that this is a case that arose in 2006. The debtor knew of his cause of action in 2006. Under the Gonzalez case, the statute of limitations started running in 2007, and this action wasn't brought until 2012. So as a matter of law, this action is also barred by the statute of limitations. If you have any other questions or concerns about the bankruptcy issues, again, there's not a single court in this country that's authorized this action. Every single court that's confronted this issue has rejected this claim as a matter of law. Baum and Curtis are squarely on point. And there's no distinction between Nevada law and California law that would warrant any type of different treatment. They both have the same firm prohibition of legal malpractice claims. The notion that this is a direct action brought by an aggrieved client by Tower Homes is a fiction. The real parties in interest are the Tower Homes purchasers. And the claim was purportedly released to them, but it's clear that there was an assignment of the right to pursue the claim. It was not previously initiated. They had the right to control the claim, and this is simply an unlawful assignment that violates Nevada law and public policy, and the district court should be affirmed.
I don't know if my colleagues have any questions. I know we have concerns, but we don't have any questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
The only issues for your consideration is our appeal of the May 15, 2014 order. That order does not deal with any issues concerning statute of limitations. The motion to dismiss regarding the statute of limitation issue was denied, and you declined to entertain it by way of extraordinary writ. So that's really not before you today, and I urge you not to even consider that issue. But I want to address one example to illustrate the fallacy of really the law firm's argument here. Let's assume hypothetically that it's a single creditor bankruptcy estate, and it's a substantial creditor. That's the only unsecured creditor is one. But the trustee says, you know what, I'm going to hire special counsel to go out and pursue a claim against a law firm so that we can satisfy that creditor's claim. First off, as the Justice Hardesty, you point out, the trustee would have that ability to go out and hire special counsel to pursue that claim. They do that routinely. Secondly, just because the proceeds of the malpractice action is going to go to benefit either, in my hypothetical, one creditor, which would thereby extinguish any standing under their theory of the case, then you would never be able to pursue a malpractice action. Anytime a trustee made the election, either in his or her own name or through a representative, or by way of a debtor. If money's going to go into the estate, obviously it's not going to go to the debtor. It's going to go to satisfy claims of the debtor, which there is a substantial interest in a debtor satisfying claims that they promised to pay. Then there would be no ability to pursue a legal malpractice claim under that theory. And in this case, it's the ability of the bankruptcy court to enter orders for the administration not only of the bankruptcy code, but also the plan of reorganization. The mere fact that a debtor can't complete its plan of reorganization, therefore defaults and doesn't, the state can't be fully administered because they were unsuccessful in their reorganization efforts, doesn't in any way minimize the benefits that the debtor at one time sought of the plan to reorganize so that they could have their debts paid. And one of those ways to do that is through a cause of action, such as a legal malpractice case.
I have one additional question. The claim that was presented in this case was made by the debtor.
Correct.
In the name of the debtor, with the approval of the trustee and the bankruptcy court.
Yes.
What is your position with regard to the analysis in the cases that counsel cites out of California, which seem to prohibit that arrangement?
Curtis, certainly Curtis does suggest that.
So if this court were to disagree, what would be the policy and legal basis for doing so? How would this court distinguish or separate itself from the legal analysis in Curtis?
That the bankruptcy court has the ability to enter orders consistent with its own jurisdiction to administer an estate. It can enter an order under Section 1123, sub 3D3 of the code, and empower the trustee, or including the debtor, to pursue a claim, which is exactly what it did here. The other aspect of that is it can, with a notice and a hearing, which it did in this case, a bankruptcy court can, and through a trustee, compromise creditor claims in a way that they receive certain benefits, but at the same time, whether they may receive proceeds, those claims will then therefore be discharged of the estate, and they won't be entitled to any further distribution, assuming the estate did receive that distribution. That's where the court in Curtis was a little wrong. They specifically said the bankruptcy court did not have that authority to do that. And I think that was an exercise of jurisdiction by the California State Court now imposing itself within the confines of the bankruptcy court, who has exclusive jurisdiction to enter orders concerning the plan, concerning compromising of creditor claims, and the administration of an estate. And that's why I'm saying that's at the core of this case, is the bankruptcy court's authority to do that, which was done here.
Okay. Do my colleagues have any questions? All right. Thank you, Mr. Prince. Mr. Ulster, thank you for your excellent briefing and your arguments here today, and the case will stand submitted.